welcome to a special weekend edition of Around and About Chattanooga. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller. Today, we have an extended interview with somebody who should be a familiar voice if you tune into WTC on Saturdays pretty regularly. She's a comedian and a frequent panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Now, panel, what will Amazon's next big thing be? Paula Poundstone.
Very soon, Amazon will simply take every penny that we make as we make it. And stuff will just show up.
Paula Poundstone is coming to town on April 28th. For a performance at Track 29, she'll be speaking to us about that. We're also going to talk about her new book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, and what it's like to be a panelist on Wait, Wait. Paula Poundstone, thank you for speaking with us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, how much preparation do y'all do in advance of each show?
I would tell you my strategy, but I hold the record for losses on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. So whatever I do just isn't working. the host, Peter Stagel, my boss, and the scorekeeper slash announcer, Bill Curtis, they have a script. Peter and Bill both go off the script occasionally, but the panelists, we have no script. We know that the questions are based on the week's news, and So I for one, you know, try to read some newspapers, and I always try to watch the news hour and listen to Morning Edition just because I do.
Yeah.
But we you know, we're aware that the questions are going to be based on the week's news, and so, you know, I think all of us try to bone up on the news a little bit when the weeks that we're on the show, some weeks more successfully than others, I guess. The only part that is written for us ahead of time, and as far as I know, none of us write jokes. You know, we all really want to get the answers correct. But the jokes are just spontaneous. The only thing that's written ahead of time is we're told the topic of the bluff story the night before. And so that we write ourselves.
The last one that I think you did, it was about two guys who lose their phones and then can't function.
Yes. Yeah. Which I'm sure has happened in real life. and then the other thing is about just maybe a little bit before we go out onto stage, the last joke, which is called the prediction, where they go, you know, well, pedal, if any of that happens, that is, that they tell us. They tell us the what the question is for the predictions just before we go out, and so we know that you know, a few minutes ahead of time. But other than that, it's all, you know, it's just a free for all of telling jokes about the week's news, which I think is the fun way to do it.
Has it changed much since Trump got elected? Has that made it easier, harder?
Well, you know, we actually, we try to have some Trump-free sections, and that's hard to do. You know, because you get talking, and somehow it all, it's just so easy to go back to him to make jokes. But, now we have to actually, you know, strategize, and you know, we have to, it's, I think that, too, is an addiction at a certain point. You know,
yeah.
We have to cut ourselves off. We have to go, okay. All right, we filled up our Trump quota for the day. No more.
And it seems like everybody's doing it now, not just Saturday Night Live, but all the late night comedians as well. It's just become kind of a nonstop thing.
You can't help it, honestly. It's not our fault. You just can't help it. It's absurd, and one needs to speak truth to power to begin with. But the absurdities of what have happened, they should not go unaddressed. They need to be addressed. You know, they just do.
Yeah.
You know, it's. I don't know. I mean, I could go on forever about it, but what good would it do me?
You're listening to a special edition of Around and About Chattanooga. I'm Michael Edward Miller. I'm speaking with Paula Poundstone. She's a comedian and a frequent panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which airs on Saturdays at WTC at 11 a.m.
Many people are suggesting that Bannon was brought down by his rival, Jared Kushner. You know, Kushner did this in addition to the other thing Trump has asked his son-in-law to do, everything. He's been put in charge of ending the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, reinventing government, and ending the opioid crisis. This is all true.
I just love the idea that he could get a family member to do all that. I mean, I asked my daughter to vacuum, and she looks at me funny. She says stuff like, well, it was your idea to live in a house.
Yeah.
Paula Poundstone also has a new book coming out in May. It's the totally unscientific study of the search for human happiness. And she does various experiments on herself, trying to figure out what is the secret to happiness. It includes experiments with her children and with her many, many pets. So you've got how many cats now?
I have 14 cats. And by the way, some of them have rejected me. my cat Wednesday just hides in the cabinet all the time. And you know what's funny? She is really the only cat that we only at this point have two cats that came from the same litter. And it was Wednesday and our cat Theo. Theo may be the most social cat in the house. And Wednesday is... she spends most of her life hiding in the cabinet in the bathroom where their litter boxes are and occasionally peeing in that cabinet. And then when that's not satisfying enough, she comes out to pee around the rest of the house. And anytime you go near her, she runs away. And I just think, is this a relationship? I feed her. I care for her. I occasionally tap the floor gently, hoping she'll come over, but nothing. I don't know if it's training for the world. If it helps me when I go out into social life, I've been rejected before. There's nothing you can do to me.
Well, how do all the cats fit into the search for the secret to happiness?
Well, there was a chapter, actually. The Get Purring chapter. The Get Purring chapter was, I decided at one point, you know, while I was writing, I was doing my regular job. Of being a stand-up comic, and my schedule is usually, Friday, Saturday, or Thursday, Friday, Saturday. There are exceptions to that rule. Sometimes I'm out longer than that, and sometimes, like this week, I'm only working Saturday night. But my point being, I'm sure there was one, that when I add in the part of, you know, writing the book, that's pretty damn cramped schedule. You know, there was not a lot of wiggle room for anything. And at one point I realized, you know, the only way the cats got pet is if I crouched slightly while walking from room to room doing chores. You know, my knuckles might drag across their heads if they were, located in the correct place. And so I decided one day, I thought, you know what? What if I just, you know, took a day and pet the cats and, you know, pet the dogs and took care of it, you know, just tended to just them. And boy, I was greasy after just a few minutes of cat petting. You never, until you really do it in an industrial way.
Yeah.
You know, you don't realize. After a few minutes. In fact, what's funny was it was during the day and the phone kept ringing with those stupid robocalls. You know, did I want, you know, the government has a deal for me with, what was it? What is the thing you always get? The
mortgage?
No, the screen, the thing that makes the sun generated.
Like solar panels on your house?
Yeah. I constantly get one for a solar panel thing, which I would be wonderful, but I don't own my house. And then all the robocall things. You
oh,
know?
Yeah.
Some of them are computers that pretend. There's the woman who goes like, ha, 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 it was so hard to reach you. It was harder than getting my kid to clean their room. You know that one?
No, I haven't gotten that one.
Yeah.
That actually sounds like a good pitch right there.
No, it's terrible because you think for a second that you know the person.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you realize, no, I don't. It's just like a creepy thing to do. You know, it's getting your attention for the, you know. And then it turns out, by the way, it's a computer anyway. It's not even a person.
Yeah.
And so, but every time that one of these stupid phone calls rang, I'm trying to sit on the floor and pet my cats, and the phone would ring, and I'd get up to answer it. And after a while, my hands were so greasy, and there was a thin layer of cat fur over my entire face. I couldn't even, I could just go into the phone. There were times I couldn't even hold the phone in my hand. It just kept slipping out. Because cats are greasy. People don't realize.
No, I mean, I've had cats, several cats over the years, but I've only had one at a time. So I've never like been able to do a nonstop marathon petting session.
That's the thing. And that's when you find out, you know, they're greasy. I remember we were at a cat show one time and there was a lady who had a hairless cat and she was describing experience of having a hairless cat. She said, you know, the cat sleeps on her pillow. When she gets up in the morning, there'll be a little grease spot left on the pillow.
Huh.
Yeah. So, you know, the fur is just covering up, you know, it's really just a disguise. Underneath, there's a greasy, fleshy creature.
With you being on the road so much, you know, you've got all these cats, other pets, you've got children. How does that work with you being on the road all the time? Do the kids and the cats just kind of take care of each other? Or?
We have a little flappy door, and they were all able to go in and out it. I just put a little bit of food on the floor, you know, and the stronger kid gets to eat. That's my feeling. I had the same nanny for, and all my kids are adults now, but I had the same nanny for, let me think. Since my daughter, Allie, was born, I think, and she's 23 now. And my nanny, although technically no longer a nanny, she still works for me. She was never live-in. I mean, she stayed the night, obviously, when I was on the road. But she still works for me, taking care of the pets when I'm gone. Because once you've experienced greasy cat petting, it's hard to let it go, I guess.
Well, I think you've done the most important, the most vital thing a cat owner can do, which is make videos of them and put them on YouTube.
It's part of my point of living. It's part of what drives me forward. Yes, I have made cat videos. I haven't done one in a while. You know, it's actually very hard to photograph a cat. It's easier to film them. It's really hard to photograph a cat, I find. You know, they have no idea about the look in the camera idea, obviously, which now, you know, kids have been photographed so often. I mean, less so my children, because, you know, I'm a single working mom with only two hands. I have boxes and boxes of pictures of the kids, but they're mostly duplicates. Because what I would do is I would take one picture and then have it duplicated and just write different dates on the back. I would tell them that their growth spurts were infrequent and that they just really enjoyed some of these activities. One of my kids said, Mom, this picture of me in 1999 in the wheelbarrow, it's the exact same as the picture of me in 2001 in the wheelbarrow. I said, boy, you loved that wheelbarrow, didn't you?
From what I understand, you did various experiments on yourself trying to discover happiness. What were some of the things you did?
Well, let's see. I backpacked in the Angeles Forest with my oldest daughter. I hugged everyone I met for a day. I rented a Lamborghini for a day. I did a very grueling, because some of them were shorter and some of them took months. So one of them was I took Taekwondo and self defense. You know, 2, 3, 4, 5 times a week. The most excruciating workout I can even imagine. Let me think.
Well, I mean, that totally sounds like a recipe for happiness, putting yourself through physical torture every week.
Well, you know, oddly, putting yourself through physical torture every week sort of is a recipe for happiness. I don't know. So when I had the idea to write the book, I thought, well, this will be a fun way to, you know, write some funny stuff. and also to sort of continue. It's really yet another memoir, which I'm allowed to do because I'm not dead yet. I wrote another book a few years before that called There's Nothing in This Book That I Meant to Say. And so it was this sort of premise that allowed this kind of playground for, you know, for thoughts and writing. But my question wasn't just, okay, if I go do something, will I have fun doing it? Will I enjoy doing that thing? Yeah, that's a good question. But the real question is, how long does whatever positive effect I get from doing that last when I return to the slings and arrows of my regular life?
Oh.
And so in every experiment, and each one is written as a science experiment, in every experiment, the analysis is the story of raising my kids and a house full of animals and doing my stand-up comedy job and just, you know, being stuck being me and, you know, for the good, bad, and the ugly. It was fun. And the truth is, mostly, you know, happiness is a biochemical process, which is really the true answer is very unromantic. It's not all the things that you think it might be. Sadly, it's the, you know, low hanging fruit that we've been told forever. You know, get some exercise, go outside, you know, eat an apple. I wish I could share with people that it was something more. You know, I wish I could tell everyone that it was driving a Lamborghini. Although, honestly, that wouldn't be good because it's terrible for the environment. You know, you hit the gas once and you can almost feel like, you know, 2 gallons go through the machine. It's an environmental nightmare. And also, the Lamborghini actually caused all sorts of problems emotionally.
Why?
Because we live in a world where there's a lot of people who don't have homes. They don't have good mental health. They don't have care. And who wants to drive by that in a Lamborghini? You know, I don't like walking by it to get on the train. It creates a much more stark reminder of the inequities, you know, the imbalance in our world. And you know, normally I just walk down the street feeling helpless to help people. And when Lamborghini, you drive down the street feeling, you know, like a jerk.
Huh.
Here's when it was good. When it was really late at night. And you know, the truth is, I live in Los Angeles. Los Angeles is really ugly. It's just ugly. Most of it. You know, there's one or two sections that could have been nice, and then they built stuff all over it and made it ugly as quickly as they could. But at night, when you can't see the actual face of the buildings, but you just see the lights, and there was a section of Wilshire Boulevard that I was driving on that's, you know, a little bit hilly, and that was great. But it only lasted a couple of minutes. And the following day, after I returned the Lamborghini, you know, my pumpkin was there in its space. So,
what do you normally drive?
A van with dents.
Ah,
you know, minivan with dents and Pop Tart crumbs.
For driving around children and animals.
Yeah, yeah, and didn't, you know, the Lamborghini? I went to put my soda bag down, you know, which normally I drop behind the seat behind me because I carry a little thermal bag with diet sodas all day long. I go to drop it in the space behind the seat. There is no space behind the seat. I go, well, where do you put your soda bag? You know, if you have a passenger, I figured when I got in the car and I realized, oh, there's no seats. There's no, you know, you couldn't, you know, you couldn't carpool. You couldn't take your kids to gymnastics or whatever, you know, their violin lessons or whatever the hell, because there's only one other seat. I'm like, well, no wonder people are happy driving it. You can only fit one kid in there.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Paula Poundstone. She's going to be here in Chattanooga, and she's got a new book coming out. When you're writing a book, how is that compared to doing stand-up comedy? Because, you know, with comedy, you're getting immediate feedback from the audience, whereas a book, it's just you by yourself.
It is there were times where I realized that the only reason I was writing was because banging my head on the wall chipped the paint. But there's a great similarity between both of those activities. it's actually having, you know, being a stand-up comic for a living and dabbling in writing, writing is so lonely for just that reason. Part of it is, you have no guideposts. You know, when I'm on stage, I often talk about stuff that I've never talked before. And one could argue that it's writing to sort of craft that thing in front of people in a sort of loose definition of the term, I suppose. Do it on paper, you do the same thing. You have some ideas that you're now flushing out just silently, but on paper. But the difference is, you're exactly right. If I'm saying it on stage, people respond at a certain point, and I sort of, it's a little bit like that game we used to play where you close your eyes where somebody hides something and they say, you're getting warmer, you're getting colder.
Oh, yeah.
Like an audience tells me when I'm getting warmer and when I'm getting colder. And sometimes, by the way, I don't base everything on that response from the audience either, because sometimes I know in my head that I'm going to get warmer a little bit later and they're going to like it all the more. Because I'm just on a path less taken in that moment and I know where I'm going and they don't. But writing was just, yeah. And the thing, you know, what makes it worse is I did have a couple of, really helpful sounding boards, which was my manager and my book agent. And I did a lot of times talk to them about what I was writing. Or I would let them, I'd send them what I was writing. But here's the thing. Even when they weigh in, and they would with voices of such authority, sometimes they didn't think the same thing. And that's when you realize, okay, it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what they think. But then, and here's the really good part, once you come to that realization, and I repeated that process over and over, I made that same mistake over and over again. But here's the really good part, is that you are forced, therefore, to go back within yourself and continue, your own idea. And plenty of really good television shows have been ruined by meetings, where the suits come in and the creative forces in the room have to present their idea to the suits, or they have to show them the script, and then the suits sort of, weigh in or really defecate on various portions of it. And because of the powers that be, one must respond to that. And then in the end, you have something that has no heart and soul to it. So to some degree, the fact that you're forced just to do it by yourself is probably a better idea anyways for writing.
That's Paula Poundstone. She's going to be here in Chattanooga on April 28th. We'll have more in a moment.
We are nearing the end of the first 100 days of the Trump administration. The news is not taking a break.
I am taking historic steps to lift the restrictions.
Obamacare remains the law of the land for the first
Judge Gorsuch is going to be confirmed.
You can count on NPR News to go beyond talking points, to demand clarity rather than confusion. Stand with the facts. Listen to Morning Edition every day. Tune into Morning Edition weekdays 6 to 10 on WUTC.
You're listening to a special weekend edition of Around and About Chattanooga. I'm your host, Michael Edward Miller. I'm speaking with comedian Paula Poundstone. She's got a new book coming out called The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. She's also going to be here in Chattanooga on April 28th for a performance at Track 29. Some of her humor comes directly from her family, experiences with her children, and so let's hear a clip from 2014, her doing stand-up on The Craig Ferguson Show.
I have a 16-year-old son at home, which is, it turns out, is one of the worst things that can happen to a person. Oh, Oh, my heavens. Sometimes at night after I get him in bed, I go into my room and complete my sentences. It's horrible. It's awful. And, you know, I feel stupid saying this, but it's true. I did a little research because it dawned on me one day that maybe girls were different than boys, and I have two older daughters. And I looked up. As it turns out, for boys, their frontal lobe doesn't come in until between 25 and 30. And that's the reasoning and organizing part. And sometimes I check on them at night, and it, nothing. It is, there's a divot there.
You had this really funny bit when you were on Craig Ferguson where you were talking about your son was 16 and applying for a job for the first time. How much of your humor is just literally repeating things your kids have said? Do you embellish, or are you just taking word for word?
You know, one of the joys of having children is that you mostly just take notes. I exaggerate sometimes. Sometimes I don't need to, but for the most part, I exaggerate. I remember one time when my son was little, and I do sort of wrestle with this. I guess I erred on the side of selfishness, to be totally honest with you. You know, because sometimes I think, you know, is it really fair that I talk about him on stage? And then other times I think, yeah, I think it is. but one time when my son was little, I guess it just dawned on him one day. You know, he said, "Mom, do you?" I think he realized, you know, I'm writing books and I'm, you know, doing this job. You know, he said, "Mom, do you talk about us on stage?" And I said, "Yeah, I was really just caught red-handed, you know." And I said, "Well, yeah, I do, honey." And I said, "But let me explain something." I said, "There's two things." I said, "First of all, I often do exaggerate, you know, because just to make it funnier." And I said, "But the other thing is, you know, the things that happen in our house are, if they didn't happen to other people too, then people wouldn't laugh. They'd just look at me like I was a freak, you know? I said, there's two things. One is, I'm not telling a story about you. I'm telling a story about me raising you. And I'm the fool, you know. I'm the one who can't figure it out. And the other thing is, you know, parenting is, honestly, it's going to be one of the loneliest jobs ever in the entire world. And one of the reasons is, A, it's incredibly hard. B, you know, everyone has some sort of opinion about it. And C, you constantly think that you're the only one. And I think it's that is exaggerated, you know, about a million times by social networking, by people not visiting one another in the flesh, you know.
Yeah.
You know, when I was growing up, my mother, you know, at a certain hour in the morning would go for coffee with our neighbor who had a kid about my age, and you know. Me and the kid would play, and my mother and her friend would share, I'm sure, about the struggles of raising their families. And that's kind of how you do it. And one would support the other and blah, 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 you know. And now people don't do that nearly as much. And one of the things I find on stage, and I, you know, I comforted my son with this thought, and I think it did. I think when I explained that to him, I think he was satisfied with that answer, because I think it's a satisfying answer, which is, one of my favorite laughs is the laugh of recognition when people go, "Oh my God, that happens to us." You know, "Oh, that happens to me." And sometimes both for the audience and for me, that is such a huge relief, you know, to go, "Oh my gosh." Like my son, for example, suffers from really very severe electronics addiction, which is a real thing. And, you know, I started talking about it and said, I heard no one talk about this for the longest time. Now there's some books coming out about it. There's the occasional article about it. But I think most parents felt what I felt, which was extreme guilt for ever having put my kid in front of a computer. And, you know, for a while I thought, I thought it was just, you know, before I recognized what the real problem was, I thought it was something wrong with both me and my son. That the simple request of can you, it's time to get off the computer now, would result in, you know, either mind-numbing arguments or huge tantrums.
Yeah.
And so I thought, you know, it's somehow us. It's something, it's us. And the truth is, it's not us. Those machines are designed that way intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very much, years from now, we're going to look back on this very much the way the cigarette companies behaved, which is they denied and denied and denied that they had done this on purpose or that they knew about it. And they did the whole time. And they, you know, the only difference is we don't give cigarettes to our children. This thing, we as parents are putting our kids in front of these machines, not realizing. And so anyways, even sharing that on stage originally, you know, I would still get this very muted response from the crowd about it, you know, because I think so many parents didn't want to say, oh, no, I did that.
Yeah.
You know, and now more and more I find people, yes, laughing, but often coming up to me after the show to say, oh, you know, I carry some books with me on the topic so that if somebody inquires or somebody shares with me that they have a similar problem at home, I hand them the book so that they get that. Yeah, it's not you. You know, you need to do something about it now, but it wasn't your fault. And it wasn't your kid's fault either, because the very section of the brain that handles self-control and judgment and reasoning and understanding consequences is the frontal lobe. And the frontal lobe shuts down with overstimulation from the computer screen.
Really?
Yes. So when you say to your little kid, okay, you need to get off the computer now, sometimes you're asking them to do something that they literally cannot do. And what happens is then the kid feels bad because, of course, when you said to your kid, you know, can you stop doing something else, right, and come in the house and have dinner? Or, you know, can you stop doing that and go do this? They were able to do that, right? So they understand the dynamic. Mm-hmm. They get that. I was asked to do something and I need to go do it now. And when they can't, then, of course, they think to themselves, well, you know, I must be a horrible person. Look how mad my mom is. I must be a terrible person. So it's just, you know, you create this cycle, and it's all because of these evil computers. Meanwhile, let me tell you, I have a silly, stupid iPhone. I do Twitter all the time. I'm as much of an addict, I suppose, in some ways as my son, although I don't tantrum over it, but I definitely feel compelled by it, you know.
Yeah.
Checking the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Instant gratification.
Right, exactly. Like it matters, honestly. Yeah. Like it really matters. Like somebody, you know the theory that friends have had before about the stoplight? You know how you push the button for the walk sign, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, 1,000 comics and 1,000 friends have had this idea that I've heard before, which is that's not connected to anything.
Right.
That's just, you know, it just goes on its cycle, and that button just gives you something to do. You feel in control, you know. That's very, you know, Twitter, who the hell knows how many times some stupid joke that I wrote got retweeted, right? It wouldn't even have to be, there would not even need to be any real calculation of that number, and I suspect that there isn't. But what I find is, because they put a number up, I keep checking back.
Yeah.
Because I want to see that number grow because it tells me, I don't know that I have value in the world. Really? The worst thing the Russians could do, forget hacking into the Democratic Party. Forget hacking into our electoral system. Hack into Twitter and tell us that, and make the number grow really slowly. They'll bring us to our knees. They don't need to hook up with Trump. Forget that.
Just slow down our Facebook pages and Twitter feeds.
Yeah, just tell us that the thing didn't get as many whatever, right? You know, as many, you know, okay, if you wanted, and I don't, but if I wanted to make Trump's head explode, I have him, you know, when he, at 3 a.m, when he begins to tweet, hack into his Twitter account, and he posts a tweet, and just put the number 12 up. Just say, yeah, that got retweeted 12 times. He dropped dead right on the spot. No, just kill him. That would kill him. That's all it takes. And by the way, I have no desire to do any such thing, but that would be the end.
Well, I've often thought somebody should come up with some sort of Facebook app that goes through your feed and auto likes your friends' posts based on keywords. So if it seems to be a sad post, it posts a sad face and so on and so forth.
Oh my God, you know, from your lips, right? It, just because you said that right now, that's happening somewhere. Yeah, I mean, it's so, if somebody had described this to us years ago before it all existed, we would have gone, oh, please.
Yeah.
Right? What are we, morons? And now, you know, here it is. It's, they all the companies use for the apps, for googly stuff, certainly video games. They all use the psychologists, behavioral psychologists, behavioral psychology to hook you. And one of the things is with this number system, you know, this whole thing where you check the number. And in fact, there was a, on the NewsHour a couple weeks ago, there was a former Google engineer that was showing how, okay, not only is there this number, but there's a little pause before the number comes up. And it's stuff like that. I mean, all of it is specifically designed, and a lot of it's based on one-armed bandit technology, you know, from,
oh, wow,
from the casinos. You know, the difference being, again, that as an adult, you may or may not make the decision to go in and play a one-armed bandit, but you don't take your kid and put him in front of it.
True.
So, you know, I believe there's something going on here that is, you know, really almost criminal in its... because we're exposing our kids to a harm that most of us don't even know that we are, and the companies do know. And again, if as an adult you choose to do that, well, I guess that's somewhat different. But you know, what you do as an adult obviously does affect your kids, and I'm going to turn as Exhibit A to Breaking Bad.
Oh, wow.
Which is my new reference point for everything, because I just started watching it. I find myself during the day saying, what would Walt do?
Very good guide for life, yes.
Yeah, I do, actually. You know what? As a parent, this is like, this is embarrassing but true, which is almost everything I say. I do still to this day think to myself when I make some sort of a parenting decision, I think about Leave It to Beaver and I think about the Brady Bunch. And the rational part of my brain keep saying to myself, you know, those were shows. Those were not real. And I still say to myself, yeah, but they did it so nicely. The early Leave It to Beavers were, you know, because people always just make fun of Leave It to Beaver that it was, it, you know, the parents were somehow perfect. In fact, the early Leave It to Beavers, A, were screamingly funny, and B, the story was not about Beaver. I don't know why they ever called it that. Story was about Ward's struggle with parenting. In fact, in the beginning of the shows, he would do a little monologue about what was upcoming in the story.
Huh.
It was him trying to figure it out. And by the way, with he was imperfectly. He often made mistakes, and oftentimes the mistakes didn't really exactly get resolved. And I think as time went away, my guess is when they wrote the scripts, the suits came in the room and messed
it
up.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a special weekend edition of Around and About Chattanooga. I'm your host, Michael Edward Miller. I'm speaking with Paula Poundstone, the comedian and frequent panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, has a new book coming out May 9th called The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. She also has a performance coming up here in Chattanooga on Friday, April 28th. Right now, we're talking about different aspects of her life and her career, including a time in 2001 when she was arrested for drunk driving. She temporarily lost custody of her children and went into rehab. Later, she talked about the experiences in her stand-up.
I had a little drinking problem, but I guess you heard already. It was kept kind of hush-hush, wasn't it? Out of deference to me and my family. I was actually court-ordered to Alcoholics Anonymous on television. Pretty much blows the hell out of the second A, don't you think?
You've been sober for, what, like more than 15 years now?
I have.
How's that going?
Well, hold on. Let me just put put the lid on this whiskey. fine till today. Great. You know, the truth is, you know, I can honestly say, I mean, talk about a corporate boondoggle. You know, I can honestly say there's not one moment in my life, not even one, that was ever made remotely better by drinking. And the weird thing about me is that I think part of the reason I drank for as long as I did was because I just kept, you know, I just kept thinking I wasn't doing it right. I just kept thinking, you know, everyone else seemed to be so good at it. And I would, you know, screw up socially, say and do stupid things. Obviously wake up in the morning feeling horrible, not even being sure what stupid thing I had done and said. And I'd think, well, wait a minute, then I didn't do it right. You know, let me try again.
Oh, yeah, practice more.
Right, exactly. Give it another shot. You know, and part of it was from the images that that we're sold on, right? That the corporations of, you know, because this is something that we've all agreed that we like.
Yeah.
So part of it was from that, you know, that perpetual advertisement. But, you know, how unsavvy could I be to keep falling for that idea for so many years? But I guess I did. But anyway, so I would say, yes, I would say that my life is much improved by not making that same mistake.
Was part of it social anxiety, like getting on stage? You needed to have a little bit of a buzz just to deal with that, or deal with people after the show that you had to meet?
You know, you tell yourself so. Sure, you tell yourself it is. But the truth is, I mean, how many times, what a lousy scientist am I, how many times did I run that experiment and find out that it didn't help?
Yeah.
I don't know. So, and you know, and then you just, and, you know, then I guess you just get hooked and you look for, you know, you look for any excuse, and the weird thing is, like in my book of experiments with happiness, as I told you, one of the things that I discovered is that it really is just this biochemical process. And the truth is, unromantic as it may seem, you know, gee, exercise, you know, go outside, you know, get some, have a good sleep hygiene, eat healthy. How come I was never addicted to that?
Yeah, yeah.
How come I never got up in the morning and said, well, wait a minute, I didn't quite eat healthy enough yesterday. Let me try that again. Or, you know, I think a few more push-ups and I would be feeling better. How come that never happened? Even the things that I came to know in the process of doing this, like volunteering, it's people have said it forever. You know, you help others and you feel better. Well, guess what? That's true. But I still, and I started volunteering in a nursing home as a result of writing my book. It was one of my experiments, and I had what I needed for the book after a couple of months of volunteering, but it just didn't seem right to me to go, okay, got what I need, see ya.
Yeah.
So 2 years later, I still, two mornings a week, I go volunteer at this nursing home, and I know that I feel better by doing it. And yet I do not spring to my feet each morning and run there. Sometimes it feels a little burdensome, the same as, you know, anything else. Part of it is because I take a dog with me each time. I have two dogs. And Ramona goes on Monday and Sirius goes on Wednesdays. And because I'm taking the dog, I walk there. And it's about a mile and a half. And I hate walking. But I feel that, you know, for the dog, it's... you know, but same thing. Do I feel better after I walk? Yeah, I do. You know, but
yeah,
you know, but this other idea, you know, of some sort of instant gratification from doing this other thing that again never made me feel good. What the hell is the matter with human beings? Because you know, so many of us make those same bad plans, you know, or follow that same ridiculous experiment mm-hmm. every single day. I don't know. We're weird. And you got to wonder, is there any other species that looks back with regret?
That's a great question, yeah.
You know, is there a raccoon who goes, what is it with man garbage? You know, they put the lid on the trash. Is that not enough to tell me? Does my dog even once go, you know what? No one likes it when I bark like that. Do I feel better from barking? No, I don't. Why am I doing it?
Dog therapy.
Yeah, yeah. You know that glopping noise I make with my mouth at night when other people are trying to settle down? Why do I do that?
Well, I think even if cats had the intellectual capacity for that, they still would regret nothing.
Oh, yeah? You don't think cats regret things?
No.
Yeah, maybe not. Yeah, maybe not. You know, my cats, particularly in the summertime when I may have some boxer shorts on during the day, get so damn hot, I'll have a cat settled in my lap and a dog will run through the room. And even though the cats have lived with the dogs for many years, the cat will decide that this is somehow a great threat and they'll jump up and basically carve their name in my leg.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And you're right. I don't think there's any regret. There's blood running down my leg. So they're like, what? What? The dog ran through the room. Of course I did that, naturally.
Paula Poundstone, thank you for speaking with us. Your new book coming out is The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. Where can people pre-order it?
From my website. There's you can go to paulapoundstone.com, and there's a little section there where you can pre-order, and that'd be great. I think I don't think it'll make people permanently happy, but I think it will. I think it'll at least add to the mix.
Thank you so much. Looking forward
really
to seeing
nice
here
with you.
And we'll see you April 28th.
Oh, terrific. Thanks a lot.
Around and About Chattanooga is a production of WUTC with contributions by the staff and volunteers of WUTC. Find us online at wutc.org.